In 2008, This American Life broadcast an episode titled The Giant Pool of Money. A huge response followed, and Planet Money was born. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we spend the entire hour with Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum of the Planet Money team. They're speaking in Ames this evening. This hour, we'll ask them about the origins of Planet Money in the 2008 financial crisis, how Planet Money approaches economic stories differently, and why that makes the stories not only more understandable, but also more fun to listen to. What questions do you think the Planet Money team should tackle? First, this news. It's heard by millions of public radio listeners. You've heard it. It presents stories that explain the economy with humor and insight. Titles like We Bought a Toxic Asset and You Can Watch It Die, or Money for Nothing and Your Cows for Free. Planet Money, of course. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, we spend the entire hour with David Kestenbaum and Jacob Goldstein of the Planet Money team. They're speaking this evening in Ames on the ISU campus at 8 p.m. They are in our Des Moines studio, or are they in their Ames studio? I'm not quite sure. Where are you, Jacob and David?
We're in Des Moines.
You're in Des Moines. You're heading to Ames this evening. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to reach out to our listeners. There'll be time for you to ask questions, especially what issues and questions would you like to see the Planet Money team tackle in the future? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And Jacob and David, welcome to the program. Let's start, if we could, by having you tell the story of how Planet Money started, because it has its seed in the financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah, it does. The two founders of Planet Money, Alex Bloomberg and Adam Davidson, had done this really like a perfect radio story at the perfect time for This American Life. It was an hour about the subprime mortgage crisis called The Giant Pool of Money. And the listener response to that was just incredible, because it explained this thing that was going on in the economy at that time, this very dramatic event, in a way that people could understand. It was narrative. You know, it told you the whole thing just unfolded in this beautiful, perfect way. And so the idea was that maybe we could do more things like that. You know, there's in the world of media, there's business coverage. There's kind of, you know, the Forbes magazine sort of personalities running companies kind of coverage. But there wasn't a lot of coverage of economics, of the deeper principles, the deeper ideas. And certainly no one was doing it in a narrative way. So the idea was maybe we could do more stuff like that. And it's a kind of funny story, because Adam, I remember, called me and said, you know, we did this thing for This American Life. It was very popular. We want to do more stuff like that. Now that the whole subprime thing is sort of passed and things are calm, we could, you know, take our time and do these long narrative explainer pieces. And, you know, this was this moment before the actual full financial crisis, where people thought it was going to be contained to just sort of subprime housing. And I remember in particular, like in one of the early days, him calling me. I was at a barbecue, and it was during the summer of 2008. I remember like the fireflies. I was standing on the porch because he called me. And it was right before Lehman collapsed and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I didn't really even know what these things were very, very clearly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the beginning of Planet Money turned out to be incredibly hectic, where Adam was basically the only person who knew economics in detail. And I was really good at explaining things. You know, I've been on the science desk for 10 years, translating sort of complicated topics. But I didn't have very much background. And as we were rushing to cover this unfolding huge economic event, you know, I kept getting distracted by little questions like, what happened to the money in the housing bubble? Like, where did it go? Or even what Ira Glass later called the most stonerous question we've ever asked, what is money? So, you know, we'd be trying to cover these breaking news events, and I'd be like, wait, what is money? What is debt? And, you know, as things slowed down, we've actually, and through the financial crisis, been able to tell a lot of those stories. And I think part of the resonance this has had is that people have very basic questions like that. And I think that's what people like about Planet Money, that we explain a lot of the very basic stuff, the invisible stuff around us.
So other things that conventional treatment of business news, economic news skips over as a given, like why explain money? We use it every day. We have to know what it is, right? Or where it came from.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of stories you read sort of make this assumption like, oh, we all know what a bond is, or we all know, you know, what money is, or even in more complicated ways. Oh, we all know what, you know, a collateralized debt obligation is. And I'll tell you, I mean, I used to work at the Wall Street Journal, and, you know, lots of people don't really know what they are. Even the people writing these stories, they don't always ask the questions to get to the bottom of it. I mean, they know what they need to know to write the story. But, you know, at Planet Money, David and I, we sit next to each other in the office. It's an open office. And literally all day long, we just sort of bother each other with these stupid questions. Like, we both have young children, and we sort of act like them. You know the way a kid says, why? And then you answer, and they say, but why that? But why that? And, like, that's largely what we do all day long.
You're getting in touch with your inner 10-year-old.
Yeah, I remember
a little too much in touch sometimes. But
I remember early on, like when I was just getting up in the morning of Planet Money, reading the paper, I read the story in the Wall Street Journal, and I was almost reduced to tears. I called Adam. I was like, I don't understand this. Like this jump between this paragraph and this paragraph. Why does that lead to that? He's like, just ignore that. He's like, that's a terrible story. He's like, they're just throwing in a bunch of economic facts that happened yesterday and trying to make it look like they're related. Nobody knows to what extent they're related. Like, it's okay to be confused by that. And I found that reassuring.
So the story here is really when economics and David, you busied yourself many years with science, but when economics is told well in a narrative, it's not dry and dust laden. It is interesting.
No, I think so. I mean, you know, I covered phys. I went to grad school in physics. I covered, you know, physics and biology and all that stuff. I will say that was in some ways easier because you always had like a, you know, a beaver fossil from a million years ago. There's some physical object, and here really often you have people and drama, but at the core of it, it is money and often spreadsheets. And in the early days, I actually bought a bunch of fake play money to have at the office because I needed to play things out to understand them. You know, I wanted to say, okay, I have this and then I buy this from you and the money goes here. Like, it really helped me make it physical. That's one of the challenges is you know, it's finding a way to animate these things.
So when you talk about this in your office, Jacob and David, you toss around ideas, somebody tosses out an idea and something goes zing, you know, instantly it's a Planet Money topic, or is it like we've got to get to this topic, but the treatment is really problematic here?
Yeah, I mean, it really varies. That's a good question, and it depends on the story. I mean, sometimes you start with an idea, you know, why do textbooks cost so much, to pick a recent one? Lots of people asked us that question. Sometimes you start with a person. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out, right? Sometimes you have just an idea, but you can't quite get it there to be a podcast. I mean, one time Kestenbaum a few months ago walked into the office with two packs of M&Ms and said, why is this one, what, like 1/10 of a gram heavier than the other one? And that turned out to be a podcast.
Mm-hmm. I remember once my colleague Hannah was – we were looking for something to do around, you know, the price of housing, because there was this question out there, like, is it at a bottom? You know, prices had really, really dropped to very low levels in some parts of the country, in particular in Florida. And so, you know, that was like a story. It was something that was happening out there, but it wasn't a Planet Money story. And then Hannah just kept calling and calling, and she finally found this girl. How old was she?
12, I think.
12, who'd bought a house in Florida. That is how low the price of houses had fallen in her neighborhood that she was able to buy one. Like, she put up some of the money from whatever.
It was like $1,000. It was like an amount of money an industrious 12-year-old could plausibly have.
Yeah, you know? Her parents chipped in. But she owned the house and was like fixing it up and renting it out. And, you know, even at that point, Hannah was like, is that a story? Like, what's the bigger idea? And I was like, well, why don't you just say, like, you know, if historians look back, they may say this was the moment where the housing market hit bottom, where a 12-year-old in Florida was able to buy a house. So, you know, that's what takes it from being sort of like an abstract idea to something more that has, you know, a real person at the heart of it or a really big economic idea in it.
David Kestenbaum is with us, along with Jacob Goldstein of the Planet Money team there in Iowa in our Des Moines studio, fielding your questions. What issues, what questions would you like to see the Planet Money team tackle? 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Des Moines. Jeffrey is in Des Moines. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yeah, hi. Excellent show. I'd like to see more direct research on how money buys Congress. I mean, if you have a Congress that has written the fewest laws ever in the history of the United States, and we sort of know that big money owns the elections, but how laws are written, or maybe more importantly, not written, because they don't serve the interests of, you know, Wall Street and the big banks, et cetera. More the direct connections to find out, you know, who owns the Republicans and Democrats and the members of our government, you know, the what's often called the best Congress that money can buy.
Jeffrey, thank you. In Des Moines, how would Planet Money, or how has Planet Money tackled politics and money?
So we've done it a few ways. I mean, first, it's sort of in direct response to the question. Like, you can actually find out largely, not entirely anymore, but largely you can find out which lawmakers have gotten money from which donors. There are a few very good websites that catalog, you know, what is public, and still a lot of it is public information. Is it the Center for Public Integrity, the Sunlight Foundation? So for specific questions, there are people doing a great job at that. When we have tackled that subject, we've tried to do it in a less specific sense, in a more storytelling sense. Our colleague Alex Bloomberg did a great series of stories, a year or two ago, where he just basically, he looked into the mechanism for how it actually works. And it turns out, you know, it's not, you know, you hear about this sort of $5,000 a plate galas, but the meat and potatoes of it, just the everyday fundraising of it, turns out all over Washington, there are restaurants. And these restaurants have, you know, little back rooms, little side rooms you can rent. And every morning in all of these restaurants, there are these breakfasts. And the lobbyists host the breakfast. And what happens is there's going to be a congressman sitting at the table. And the industries that want to get in front of that congressman will pay some amount of money. That amount of money is fundraising for the congressional campaign. And they get to come and sit at the table and talk to the congressman. I mean, that is a thing that happens. And the stories of how it happens, you know, are just compelling for the basic details.
Jacob, we don't see any of those meetings in any campaign commercials here in Iowa.
I guess nobody approved that message.
The other thing you don't see that came out in some of that reporting was just the daily grind of it for these congressmen. You know, being like their staff will be like, no, I'm locking you in that room. You have to pick up the phone and call 100 people and say the same charming thing to them and try and get them to give you money. You know, and it's just relentless and almost nobody likes the system.
I did a story this summer, a sort of related story. Also, there's this guy named Lawrence Lessig, who is this kind of nerdy law professor, and he sort of rose to prominence after being involved in the Microsoft antitrust case, I don't know, 10, I guess 15 years ago now. And then he got involved in campaign finance, and this year he launched what he called a super PAC to end all super PACs. And he has gotten some very large donations from some very rich people.
That's the mission of it. The mission of his super PAC is to eliminate the thing
got
that
it,
he's
got
made.
It, yep. Yeah.
And so they are actually getting millions of dollars in donations, including from people both liberal and conservative. Peter Thiel, the libertarian billionaire, has given them a lot of money, I know. And they are actually backing candidates. I mean, they are, you know, basically trying to buy candidates the way PACs try and influence elections. And they are backing candidates who want to basically reduce the role of big money in politics.
Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum with us of the Planet Money team, fielding your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk about some of the projects, the fascinating projects that you've done. Let's the T-shirt was a really fascinating project. For those who didn't catch us, tell us what you did with a T-shirt.
So this was based on inspired by a book by a professor at Georgetown called Pietro Rivoli. It's called The Travels of a T-shirt in the Global Economy. And she basically followed, you know, she laid out the whole international market for T-shirts. And we thought we wanted to do that, but we wanted to do it differently. We wanted to actually make a shirt and follow it around the world, you know. And we didn't really know how many people were going to be into this idea. You know, so we started a Kickstarter campaign and we said, look, we want to make this shirt and we're going to follow it all over the world to all the places it goes to get made. And we're going to do stories about that. Would you like to buy one of these shirts? And we set as a goal $50,000, and we started the Kickstarter campaign and it went to almost $600,000. Mm. Something like 20,000 people ordered shirts. And I remember I remember as the Kickstarter campaign started, you know the way these things work is you set a goal and then it sort of goes public and you look. And I remember seeing when it was clear we were going to make the goal, and I was like, yes, yes, we're going to make the goal. And then it just kept going and going and going. And I thought, oh, my gosh, like 20,000 T-shirts, 600, that's a lot. That's the biggest thing we've ever done. I hope we don't screw this up. But it was a great project, actually. We shot a lot of beautiful footage that just won an Emmy. It's on npr.org/shirt. It was a really fascinating
experience. I've watched most of the videos connected with really beautiful shots there, too. But also, you two and anybody who's watched this will never look at a T-shirt or the label of a T-shirt in the same way. Do you find yourselves really examining those labels now?
I mean, no is the honest answer to that question.
Right.
But I mean, I do think, certainly I think differently about globalization, right? I mean, it doesn't mean I look at every shirt and think of what country does it come from. Because, I mean, one of the interesting things to me about the T-shirt project is, like, it's not clear what to do about it, right? You look and you see, you literally see when you watch these videos, oh, people who make T-shirts in the developing world have a very, you know, a difficult job, a rough life. But that does not necessarily mean we should not buy T-shirts from them, right? The people who work in T-shirt factories are doing that because largely they're coming from villages where their lives are even more difficult, right? So, you know, one of the things that I still think about in the universe of the T-shirt project is it's not clear sort of, you know, what do we do about it? We see this suffering. We see this difficult life. And there's no obvious solution. Mm.
I wonder, in all the years that you've been doing this, since 2008 approximately, I know, Jacob, you've been on board since 2010, I believe. Do you see a shift in the way people are understanding? I mean, if you're increasing awareness, perhaps we could start with your own understanding, because you don't necessarily have money backgrounds, economic backgrounds. Has it changed you as a person, the way you go through life and think about day-to-day interactions?
It has for me, certainly. Like, you know, my background was in physics, and I always felt like physics was like it allowed you to see the invisible forces behind everything. It was a really interesting way to look at the world. And I feel like economics is that sort of, you know, for modern life, really. So it has changed it for me. In terms of our listeners, you know, we get emails from people saying, I just discovered you and I went back and listened to all 500 episodes or whatever. And I think if you do that, like, you get a pretty good understanding of a lot of pieces of the global economy and how things work.
Let's examine another one of your projects, one of your pieces. This had to do with examining what trading is all about, a piece that dealt with seventh graders, and started off with the discussion of gift giving and how inefficient that is. Set this up for us. Who wants to do that, Jacob or David?
It was David's story.
So it was inspired by this book, as I recall, the title is Scroogenomics, written by an economist opining about how much he hated Christmas and holiday gift giving because people often got things they don't want. It's the same problem, frankly, at Halloween we're about to hit, you know, which is that you go to someone's house and, like, they've put out a bunch of now and laters because they think that's what everyone's going to want, but, you know, I don't like now and later. So this was the problem. And we went to a middle school in Brooklyn to sort of explore this idea. And we brought a bunch of candy. And we handed out the candy randomly. Each kid got a piece. So one kid got, like, a Kit Kat. Another kid got, like, a Nutter Butter. And someone got Fig Newtons. And we went around and we said, how happy are you with what you have? Like, from 1 to 10, how much value does it have for you? And everyone gave a number, and we added them up on the blackboard, and it came to about 50. So on average, everyone was a 5 between 0 and 10. And then I said, well, what should we do? And one kid, in really like about 10 seconds, he stumbled around and he came up with the idea of trading. Like, in 10 seconds, he basically came up with the idea of a market. You know, people throughout civilization have done this. It's a very, very natural thing, and I watched it happen with a bunch of 7th graders. He said, why don't we trade? So I said, all right, we'll give you like 30 seconds to trade your pieces of candy to someone else if someone else wants to trade with you. And it turned into this like stock market frenzy. You know, I remember this one kid who held like a Kit Kat above his head so that someone could find him if they wanted a Kit Kat. And there was this scrambling and this swapping and swapping again. And then we stopped.
And we've got a bit of audio to pick up with right from the story. So you led us right up to this bit of audio from the piece that explains trading. Let's listen.
So we ask everyone again to value what they have now.
My name is Genesee, and I got sour patches. And it's a 10 because I love sour patches.
And what were you before?
A 0.
Oh, so you went from a 0 to a 10.
Yeah.
Oh, my name is Justin. I've traded a fig for raisins. So now it was a 0 to a 1. This is better.
From fig Newtons to raisins is a 0 to a 1. Okay. We add the numbers up, and the total wealth has gone from 50 way up to 82.
Okay, so that's a little excerpt from that. So they were fascinating because another instance of trade. We don't think of what's behind that word trade and why we trade goods.
I just love the kid who got raisins because, like, I remember when I was a kid, you trick-or-treating, and there's that, like, one house in 20 where they'd give you raisins. I don't know if that happened to anyone else or just because I'm from California. But, like, be like, come on, it's Halloween. Raisins, I would give them negative value in that case. Like, I would rather have nothing than raisins if I'm 10 years old and it's Halloween.
Yeah, this is really like the value of markets. This demonstrated the value of markets and also of trade. Like, we didn't bring anything else into the room, right? We didn't like create anything. All we did is allowed people to exchange stuff. And all of a sudden, the value, the net value in the room had jumped.
Mm-hmm. What reaction did you – do you receive any specific reaction to that piece, David?
From the students, I remember giving them that like dramatic pitch at the end, like, see what we just learned. And they're like, yeah.
They were not as astounded as you by what they did.
No, you know, I don't know. I sort of wish it landed bigger. I think that's probably the life if you're a teacher in middle school. You have these grand plans. But it was really, really fun to go. And to see, I was just amazed. You know, the kid in like 10 seconds, he's like, maybe we could trade? Like, it just happened like that.
Mm-hmm. Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum with us. We have to take a break in just over a minute. But before we do that, we want to talk about some more of your projects that you've been into in the second half of the show. But before that, tell us, are there key principles that apply to any Planet Money piece, things they all have in common?
So, I mean, I feel like the best pieces have basically two things in them. One is a human story, you know, a person in a place doing a thing. They have some problem. Typically, it's a story. They have some problem. Something happens. Maybe they solve the problem. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're different in some way after. And then this human narrative, a basic story, the most natural thing, illuminates some broader idea. So like a person and a story and then some bigger idea that emerges through that story.
And what's the most satisfying reaction you get to a piece?
I like it when my mom likes it. She almost always likes it, and it's nice.
My wife doesn't hate it.
Isn't that true of everybody?
Actually, my wife is very generous. But, you know, I feel like the people who are honest with me, I like it. I like when someone gives me honest feedback, like about what parts were working and what parts weren't working. We edit in a kind of unusual way, which is it's not just the editor and the reporter. Like, the entire Planet Money team goes and sits in this very small office, and we run through the piece before it airs, and everyone just sort of lets loose very bluntly. The first thing we say is, we're not going to kill it. Because when you're reading, your first draft of a piece, like, that's the question in the back of your head. And if everyone's very polite to you at the beginning, you're suspicious that it's really...
It's already past that hurdle, awful. So it's not going to be killed. It's just going to be helped.
But, you know, everybody really, they talk about, like, where they're getting lost in the story, what's not working for them emotionally, where they're confused, where it seems boring, you know. And often pieces really change a lot in that. So, like, what you're hearing on the radio is very different from where it started.
David Kestenbaum with us, along with Jacob Goldstein of the Planet Money team. We have them for the second half hour as well. We'll talk about some more ideas that they've brought to our radios. For instance, how UPS represents how business is developing with high tech. Why gold was chosen as money? There's a fundamental question we never seem to ask, but the Planet Money team did. We'll talk about that when we return. Also, the details in your home insurance, those details you never read. It turns out it makes fascinating radio. We'll be back with David Kestenbaum and Jacob Goldstein. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Jacob Goldstein and David Kestenbaum of the Planet Money team. You've heard their reports, and they've attracted your interest, presenting stories that explain the economy with humor and insight in a different way. And we're talking about some of the reports that they've done. We'd like to have you join our conversation. What issues and questions would you like to see the Planet Money team tackle? 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. David and Jacob, I wanted to bring up another interesting piece that you you put forward here. A charity, and this really goes along with the idea that we were talking, that simplicity is best, it seems, for the Planet Money team, asking questions that are so obvious, perhaps they get overlooked. You looked at a charity that just gives money. And tell us the story of how you arrived at that. It's called Money for Nothing and Your Cows for Free.
Right. So a few years ago, I learned about this new small charity. It's called Give Directly. And what they do is they give money to very poor people in rural Kenya. They give grants of about $1,000. It's a one-time grant. And there are no strings attached. It's not like you have to give money and then do this training and start a business, or, you know, you'll get this money if you get your kids vaccinated and send them to school. No, it's just, here is money. Do anything you want with it. We don't care.
And it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. Yeah. It's, so it's $1,000 for the families that are getting this money is about as much money as they make in a year, right? So imagine whatever you, and if you have a spouse, your spouse make in a whole year, somebody just coming out of nowhere, coming to your town, having a meeting and say, we're going to give you whatever. We're going to give you $50,000. Don't care what you do with it. It's yours. Enjoy.
Right. So, and anybody would be suspicious, as the person in the piece is.
Sure, sure, right.
Said, what kind of scam is this?
What kind of scam? Some people thought it was the government trying to buy votes. People thought people didn't know what to think. People were definitely suspicious at first. But, you know, we went to some of these villages. We were actually able to travel to Kenya and talk to people. And, you know, not surprisingly, ultimately, people said, sure, I will take free money. And, you know, the interesting question here, I mean, this is a really interesting story to me because I have these two sort of immediate and opposite reactions to it, right? Like, on the one hand, it feels like, oh, of course, what do poor people need? They need money. That's why they're poor. They don't have money. But, I mean, on the other hand, you think, well, is that really the smartest way to help people? You know, presumably there are some people who, if you give them money, a few people you could imagine might drink it away. You could imagine other people might be well-intentioned, but, you know, they've never seen that much money in their life. They could be embezzled. They might just have a bad business idea and just kind of waste it.
So we heard, I mean, they were the people who were getting the money were at first skeptical, but also people in the charity world are very skeptical of this idea. We talked to a former head of UNICEF who said, who listed, she gave us just this list of things, ways it could go wrong. Like people could spend it on drugs, on alcohol, on weapons, or they could just not spend it very well. You know, people have these ideas for businesses that just don't work out.
And David, that's what I found the most captivating part of this this piece for Planet Money, and we have a little bit of audio there here, is that you present this idea to some of the aid groups that we know and contribute to, and their reaction is astounding. Let's have a listen.
The Economist's ideal Christmas would be people sitting around handing each other money, and in a perfect economic world, the ideal charity would be basically the same thing, people giving away money, letting the recipients do whatever they think is best with it. But in the charity world, this idea seems foreign.
I've never come across another charity that just gives money.
This is Chris Blattman. He's a professor at Columbia, and he actually studies giving money to poor people in the developing world.
In a dozen countries and hundreds of NGOs, I've never even heard of it. I've never heard of anybody ever doing this. I've heard of people saying, maybe we ought to try this, or wouldn't that be interesting? But nobody's ever done it as a charity, as far as I know. That's nuts.
We talked to lots of people at aid groups. We talked to a former head of UNICEF. We talked to people at local and international groups in Kenya. And almost all of them thought just giving money was a bad idea.
They basically told us, look, if you spent a lot of time on the ground trying to help people, you would know this is not a good idea. The real world is not some perfect economic model. It's filled with people. They told us some people will buy alcohol with the money, or, you know, they'll mean well, but they just won't spend it very well. At the very least, they said you have to provide some kind of education. You have to help people so they can do something smart with the money.
One of the people we talked to was Morris Wambia. He works for Heifer International in Kenya. This is a group that's basically at the other end of the spectrum from Give Directly. Heifer doesn't give cash. It gives cows and goats and other kinds of livestock. And it provides a lot of training on how to be a successful farmer.
I think the training aspect has to be there in any activity you want to do.
What if you don't do training? What if you just give money?
I'm telling you today that you will not succeed. You will not succeed. Without any training, you cannot succeed in any project.
That's an excerpt from Money for Nothing and Your Cows for Free of Planet Money. David and Jacob, so what is the takeaway from this piece? What did you discover? Is giving money, simply money, a bad or good idea?
I think it's a good idea. I mean, I'll just say that. And, you know, not to – charity is good in general, right? Like you heard in that clip you played, you heard a man from Heifer International. And to be clear, like giving someone a cow is better than not giving them a cow. So just put that aside for a moment. From everything we can tell so far from the reporting we've done, give directly, just giving money, at least in this setting, to poor people in these rural villages in Kenya seems to be working. And I say that for a few reasons. One is just what we saw when we went there. We spent a few days walking around these villages and talking to people. And from what we could tell, we did not find people who were, you know, squandering the money on alcohol or whatever. One thing, probably the most common thing people did with the money was to buy metal roofs. And so what that means is the people who got the money, at the time they got it, they were all living in these mud huts with thatch roofs, roofs made of grass. And roofs made of grass, first of all, they're terrible roofs, right? When it rains, you get wet and bugs get up in them. But the really surprising thing to me is you need, I guess, this special kind of grass for this roof. You can't just go out and pick it, and you have to buy it. And it's somewhat expensive, and you have to replace it year after year after year. A metal roof costs a lot more up front. It costs several hundred dollars, which is a tremendous amount for the people who live here. But in the long run, it's actually cheaper, right? And they know this. You know, it's not hard to do the math. It's just that they never at one moment have the, whatever it is, $300 or $400 they need to go out and buy this roof, right? So they get this lump sum of money, and they make a really smart investment that's going to save them money in the long run.
Mm-hmm. And let me just make a point, which is that, like, as far as I know, there are no charities that are devoted to giving people metal roofs, right? And yet this is clearly a top priority for a lot of these people. If you ask them what they need most, this is clearly something that's at the top of a lot of their list. So, you know, this is kind of at the heart of the idea, which is that people have different needs. They know what their needs are, and if you give them money, they can buy it.
Now, and we don't live in their world, on their planet, so to speak. And so this is giving them not only the means but the decision of what to do with the money.
That's right. I mean, let me make the case on the other side for a second. So we went to a nearby village where people were getting cows from Heifer International. And these were super impressive cows. This was like a giant cow, like no other cow we'd seen when we were there. It almost ate my microphone, this cow. And you know, the people who got the cows, A, were incredibly grateful. And they were grateful because they'd also gotten training. Like, someone had come there and made sure they didn't fail. They didn't just drop a bunch of money and let them hope things worked out. You know, they brought them a cow. They taught them how to raise the cow. And when they have when the cow has offspring, they will give that to somebody else. So, you know, I think it's a question. Like, if you want to spend money, you can ask a question like, where do you get a bigger bang for the buck? And so the Give Directly people are trying to study what they do. And they're setting up – they have one village where people get money, another village where people don't get money. They're comparing the results. But ideally what you'd like to do in this situation is in one village spend the money on cows and training, another village just give people the money, and then you could track the two of them and see how it works.
Mm-hmm. Another topic that you looked into, why gold was chosen as money. What prompted you to take a look at gold? And we think gold is the obvious choice for money. It's not our money anymore, but it has been through thousands of years.
Well, you know, this was a story we started out. We went and actually bought some gold in the gold district. And even the guy selling the gold was like, I was like, why is it $1,300 an ounce? He's like, I have no idea. He said, you can't eat it. You can't build a house out of it. It's just the metal. He's like, I don't know. And so that was interesting to me. And I started to wonder, like, why gold? Why not osmium? Why not all these other elements in the periodic table? You remember, I came from a science background. So we went up to a professor of chemistry at Columbia University, and we went through the entire periodic table with him, you know, that list, the chart you get in like high school chemistry class. And he went through and basically started ruling out stuff that you couldn't, you know,
what you couldn't use as money. So he was like, well, these are gases. Draw a line through those. These are radioactive. You don't want to put those in your pocket, and they start to decay and go away. Draw a line through those. Then he drew a line through everything that would basically rust or that was reactive or would stick to other stuff. And he was left with just the precious metals. And then he went through and eliminated them for various reasons, like this one only melted at very high temperatures. This one's too rare. It only comes in on asteroids. And, you know, very quickly you were left with silver and gold. Silver tarnishes a little bit. There's frankly like too much of it, you know, to use his money. He wants a thing a little more rare, and he was left with gold. It was this amazing little detective story. Like he played bingo with the periodic table chart and ended up with a circle around gold.
So if we had to do it again, it would likely be gold again. If
that's
we could.
There was not some accident. I sort of thought it might be like a historical accident, but it seems like it was not. There's like there are real reasons why it was gold.
David Kestenbaum with us and Jacob Goldstein of the Planet Money team talking about some of the stories they've covered. It's hundreds in the meantime. How many did you say?
We've done well over 500 podcasts at this point. I've lost count, but we passed 500 a few months ago.
There's some repeats in there, but
no, the repeats don't get a new number.
Oh, they don't get a new number. Okay.
Do you worry that there is going to be that the universe is not infinite for Planet Money?
Yes, we worry every day. If you have any story ideas for us, we're looking.
Let's talk about a fascinating story about where you followed, traced a UPS truck. Now, something that most of us have experienced, a UPS truck delivering, I don't know, some shoes, some slippers, I don't know. But
Diapers,
whatever they've been delivering. What did you want to get across here in this piece?
Well, so the amazing thing to me about a UPS truck is it looks just like the UPS trucks that we all saw when we were kids, whatever, decades ago in my case. But the UPS truck of today is actually this incredibly high-tech vehicle. It's basically like a giant computer masquerading as a truck, or that also happens to be a truck. What UPS has done has put all these sensors all over the truck, so they now track everything their drivers do every day. And when the driver gets back to the base at night, there's a little antenna in the back of the truck, and it sends wirelessly the data to the local base computer, and then that sends the data to the big national UPS computer. And so the data guys at UPS know for every driver how much do they back up every day. When is their a little side door open? When is their seatbelt buckled? How fast are they going? Everything you could imagine. When is the engine going? How fast are they going? And so there are a number of effects this has, right? And the reason I'm interested in it is because I think that's what work is going to be like for all of us soon, right? It's getting easier and easier to collect data, and employers are doing it more and more. And so there's the obvious part of this, which is like, oh, no, my boss is looking over my shoulder all the time. And that is a valid response. And I actually went out to rural Pennsylvania and rode around with a UPS guy.
In fact, we have some audio of that. Let's listen to this. This is you, Jacob. You were on this trip?
I was. And in fact, David's going to make me say this. I actually had to wear the brown UPS uniform because they make you do that to get on the truck. I saw him about to say that, so I beat him to it.
Okay. Jacob, here's a little bit from that piece about the UPS truck and perhaps the future of all our work.
So we got horses here, dogs all around us.
This is Bill Earl. He's been driving a UPS truck in rural Pennsylvania for about 20 years.
I'd advise you not to get out of the truck here.
Bill pulls out that thing you sign your name on when the UPS guy gives you a package. It's actually a little handheld computer. And he shows me. It knows where he is, and it knows where the dogs are.
Here, that and means that there's a special note at this address. So let's go in here. I'm going to hit my note button and see what it says. Uh-oh, beware of the animal. So, yeah, and that will actually, when we get there and we enter that address, it'll actually pop up and go, you know, it'll warn you, watch out for the doggy because it's going to be right behind you. You know?
Today on the show, the future of work in America looks like a brown truck full of cardboard boxes.
Very interesting. Why all of this is data-driven, one of the facts in there, Jacob and David, that 1 minute of idling per day, and when you consider how many UPS trucks there are around the world, 1 minute of idling per day costs, what did you say, $500,000 per year to UPS?
Yeah, so I talked to UPS's data guy, and he is like a font of those random factoids about UPS trucks. And, you know, this cuts in two very different ways, right? And the driver, Bill Earle, who I went out with, was, it seemed like, really honest and open about this, and I really appreciate it. I mean, so, you know, there is the boss looking over your shoulder constantly thing. And he talked in particular about backing up, right? Backing up is less safe than driving forward, and so UPS wants its drivers to minimize backing up. And there is this moment when he is backing up the truck, and he's, you know, talking about the fact that they know exactly how far he backs up and where. And I'm like, do they ever tell you, don't back up so much? And he said, every day they tell me that. So that is, from the point of view of workers, that's the unappealing part of this. There is a better side of it, which is all this technology means UPS drivers can now deliver lots more packages every day. And at least in the case of UPS drivers, as their productivity has gone up, as they've been able to deliver more packages per day, their wages have gone up as well. So even though, you know, so the cost in a way to drivers like this guy, Bill Earle, is the boss is looking over their shoulder, they got to deliver more packages. But at least in their case, the benefit is the wages are going up.
And it also explains something, or I surmise it explains something that happens. I live on a cul-de-sac and I see the UPS. I'm perhaps waiting for a T-shirt or something. And I'm waiting, and the UPS truck in the morning whizzes by my house and delivers something to the end of the cul-de-sac. And I go, okay, it's going to be there when it swings back around the cul-de-sac. And it whizzes right past. It doesn't have it. Later in the day, or maybe 2 hours later, the UPS truck comes by. And in this piece, we learned about what you call the traveling salesman problem. That truck could have actually have had my package, but the driver said, it doesn't make sense to deliver it right now?
Yeah, not the driver usually, some fancy computer now, right? This turns out to be a profoundly difficult math problem, right? And part of it is maybe your T-shirt was just a regular UPS shipment supposed to be delivered anytime that day. And the thing he was delivering when he went to your next door neighbor's house had to be there by 10 in the morning. So then you have this complicated question like, well, I got this other thing right here I could drop off. Oh, but I got all this other stuff I got to drop off by 10. And this turns out to be a really hard problem to solve. But when you get it all right, something computers are really good at.
I mean, it used to be the drivers would have to sort of figure it out on their own. Like, maybe I'll put these packages in the back of the truck because they're all in the same neighborhood. They have to, like, think about all that stuff. And now there's some algorithm that's, like, crunching those numbers. And all that means they can deliver more and more packages.
One of the topics you looked at that is something very relevant to many Iowans, unfortunately, is because it pertains to what happens to houses when they're natural catastrophes, like floods we've had several times in recent years. You looked at homeowners insurance and found a very interesting piece in the details that none of us like to read and few of us do.
Yeah, so I actually bought a home for the first time about a year ago, and I got homeowners insurance for the first time, and I got my policy. And because I'm a nerd, because I am who I am, I read it. And it's amazing. Like, I encourage you to read your homeowner's policy, not like to be a responsible adult, but just because it's fantastic, right? Like, it's I found out that I am covered if a volcano spews lava onto my house. Now, I live in Brooklyn. As far as I know, there's no volcanoes in Brooklyn. But, you know, okay, great. I'll take it, right? I'm covered if a missile crashes into my house. That's, you know, God forbid, right? But, okay, I'm covered. On the other hand, if that volcano causes an earthquake and the earthquake damages my house, I am not covered. If the U.S. is at war and as a result of that war, a missile hits my house, I am not covered. And, you know, this is one of those ones where, like, I start with this little thing and then you find inside this there are ideas, right? This is not just the insurance company trying to take advantage of me or trying to weasel out of paying claims. It turns out there are fundamental ways insurance works and does not work that are at play here, right? Like, insurance is really good at covering kind of one-off events. So the classic version of that would be a fire. If there is a fire at my house, there is not a higher risk that there's going to be fire at a house a mile away or 100 miles away or 1,000 miles away, right? But if there is a war and my house is damaged in a war, there is a much higher risk that lots of other houses a mile away across the country are going to be damaged in a war. And insurance is sort of built on math, and it's built on math that, yeah, you basically know how many fires there are going to be each year. And one fire doesn't mean there are going to be lots more fires. That's how insurance works. It is not built to cover things like war. And frankly, it just collapses when it tries to cover them.
Mm-hmm. And one of the aspects, too, that I learned is what you call moral hazards is that your insurance is trying to alter your behavior or prevent bad behavior in the case of bed bugs, for instance.
Yeah, right. So bed bugs, I don't know if bed bugs are a thing here, but periodically in New York, like if you turn on the local news, there's some like, you know, frenzy about bed bugs. Bed bugs are not covered by my policy. No vermin is covered, which is too bad. I have mice that I've been fighting, but I'm fighting them. I'm fighting them at least to a draw. And so the reason for this, as you said, is moral hazard. And the basic idea of moral hazard is this, is once I have insurance, then there is less reason for me to worry about my house, right? So another example is if there is like if a pipe bursts and there's a ton of damage in my house, I'm covered for that, right? But if there is a slow leak, drip, 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 and in 2 weeks it causes some damage, I'm not covered for that. This is the insurance company trying to prevent me from saying, I don't care that this pipe is leaky. I have insurance. I'm just going to let it make a hole in my floor. Then I'm going to file a claim. Then I'm going to get paid for it. And then I'm going to be fine. They don't want me to do that.
So many fascinating topics. We've run out of time. Quickly, what are your words of the future of Planet Money? Any bright ideas on the horizon, how it will change?
We're right now working on a project where we want to short a stock. You know, everyone's talking about what stock do I buy, what stock do I buy. We want to short something and do a bunch of stories about shorting. Okay. I'm actually partial to shorting the entire stock market, so we can just say we're short America just because it would make a good and unpleasant headline.
But David Kestenbaum, thank you very much. Jacob Goldstein of the Planet Money team. They're speaking this evening in Ames at the ISU campus at 8 p.m. David and Jacob, thank you for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I'm long America.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. It's a News Buzz tomorrow on the program. We hope you'll tune in again over the noon hour. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.